It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Over the last 25 years, an estimated 40 million Americans have stopped attending church. There are lots of different reasons, ranging from a lack of time or motivation to leaving deliberately because of negative experiences or loss of faith. Now, for the first time in history, the number of Americans who never go to church is outpacing the number who attend weekly. According to our next guest, this large-scale unchurching isn't just a concern for individual congregations or denominations that are losing membership. It's a change that can hold up a mirror to American politics and society. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear your story. Did you regularly attend a worship service? Maybe every week? Has that declined? What led to that? Or have you left altogether? If you're still going, are you seeing empty pews in your neighborhood more and more? What do you think might be behind that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ryan Burge is an associate professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University, where he researches religion in the United States. He did the research and data analysis for a new book called The Great De-Churching. Who's leaving? Why are they going? And what will it take to bring them back? Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
Always a pleasure to be here.
We've talked before, Ryan, on the show about your work on the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, people leaving religious affiliation. And it seems like this amazingly big social trend that for a lot of people is under the radar. Could you talk about the scale, the scope of this de-churching and where it fits into American history?
Yeah, I've been telling people that I think this is the biggest cultural shift of the last 100 years. I mean, we've never seen this many people leave institutions at the rate they're leaving. According to this book, 40 million people have de-churched over the last 25 years. That is more than the number of people who became Christian during the first and second Great Awakening and all the Billy Graham Crusades combined. So if all those gains that American history has seen towards Christianity have all basically been lost over the last two or three decades during the Great De-Churching.
Well, we've talked in the past, the mainstream Protestant denominations seem to be having a lot of the biggest losses, and that's been going on over time. Same with Catholics. In the new book, there's a lot of focus on research on evangelical Christianity. What are we seeing there? Are they starting to see the same kinds of trends?
Yeah, for a while, they really were exploding rapidly. In 1972, about 17% of Americans were evangelical. But around 1993, the share of Americans who are evangelical got to 30%. That's the highest it's ever been. And from that point forward, it's really been nothing but a slow and steady decline. Today in America, about 21, 22% of Americans identify as evangelical, so down 8% from their peak. And all the evidence is pointing to the fact that evangelicalism is not going to be able to, you know, resist the trend towards secularization. Obviously, you know, Catholics and mainline Protestants have lost a lot more, but evangelicalism is not nearly as strong nor as cohesive as it was in America even 20 or 30 years ago.
Now, a key point here is de-churching, no longer attending church at all or on a regular basis, isn't necessarily the same as de-faithing. And as you break down different groups of people, a lot of people who have left church may still keep at least some sort of the faith they left. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So really what I love about this book is these two pastors, Jim Davis and Michael Graham, came to me and said, we have this idea for a book. Can you help us? Can you do the data for it? And I said, sure, I'd be happy to. So my friend Paul Jupe and I did all the data behind the scenes. They were really focused on an interesting aspect of religion that the scholars don't think about a lot. And that is not people who we think a lot about, people who used to be evangelical and now are none, for instance. This book is about people who used to attend church at least once a month or more and now describe their attendance as seldom or never, so less than once a year. And this is such an interesting aspect because sometimes people can de-church, but not de-evangelical or de-Catholic or de-mainline. They still identify as, you know, evangelical or mainline or Catholic, but they haven't gone to church in decades. So in some ways, they're still religious from a belonging perspective, but from a behavior perspective, they're not religious at all.
Let's look at some of the different categories of people and why they left church. One is, this is interesting to me, casually de-churched. We're a busy society. It can be hard to find time to hang out with our friends and family. And sometimes it sounds like for a lot of people, that church habit just sort of gradually falls by the wayside.
Yeah, that to me is the biggest takeaway from this book. And the thing that I learned more than anything else is the number one reason people de-church in America over the last 30 years is not because of politics. It's not because of theology. It's actually because they moved. Something so incredibly basic. You know, we hear these stories about these dramatic, like, I walked out of church because they took a stand on LGBTQ or abortion or women pastors or kind of these big social issues. What really happens for most people, according to this research, is they sort of slowly slide away from religion over time. There's not this like single inflection point where they were, you know, they were going every week and they stopped going at all. You know, they went every week and then they went once a month and then they went once every 2 or 3 months. And then now they're going once a year. And then all of a sudden they haven't gone in 3 or 4 years. And it's not really a conscious decision on a lot of their parts. A lot of it's just they sort of got away, got out of the habit, and just don't really feel a strong pull to get back in that habit, back to church.
We are talking to Ryan Burge about his work on this new book, The Great Dechurching, looking at this big movement, kind of under the radar for some people, about people leaving churches. The research here focuses on Christianity in particular. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Lots of callers. Let's start talking to you. Rob is with us in Wausau. Rob, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I just wanted to kind of say that church is becoming too political, and I stay home with my children and we still have faith and I try to teach them, you know, the right way, but just the politicalness and it's just going too far.
Rob, thanks a lot for the call. And Ryan, in the book, there's two categories of people who might agree with that. People on the left, let's put that really loosely, who don't agree with their church's teaching, maybe on LGBTQ issues or abortion or Donald Trump or you name it, and people in the book described as a secular right who think the church teachings are too liberal or not political enough. Can you talk about, Rob, certainly not alone in that.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, churches can't win, right? They're too much or not enough of left or right. And I think, honestly, the perception here is different than the reality. You know, we in other surveys, we've asked people who go to church every week, has your pastor spoken about any of these issues over the last 12 months from the pulpit? And we're talking everything from immigration to healthcare to abortion, you know, big issues and small issues. And 1/3 of people say their pastor's not mentioned a single issue in the last 12 months. And 52% chose one issue or zero issue from that list of 10. So I think some of that is perception. And pastors are not dumb. They're very strategic about how they act on Sunday morning. And they realize by being political, they're feeding into Rob's problem, which is they're being too much of this thing and not enough of the other thing. Michael Jordan was once asked, why aren't you not more political? And he said, because Republicans buy sneakers too. You know, pastors, they realize that if you go out on the limb on this issue to the left or this issue to the right, you're going to alienate a part of your congregation either way. And so I think a lot of pastors have tried to take the middle way and really not got into the politics as much as they possibly can.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rob. Before we go back to our callers, I want to meet another category of people you separate out in the book who have de-churched. Ex-evangelicals.
Yeah, that's such a category online. Ex-evangelicals are people who grew up in the evangelical church. For instance, I grew up in the evangelical church, and now in the 1990s, by the way, which if you look back at like the data, that's when peak evangelicalism was happening. There were more evangelicals than ever before. They're politically and culturally more, were stronger than they've ever been, and now they faded a bit. But, you know, a lot of those kids now who grew up evangelical in their 30s and 40s and really thinking back on the purity culture and the gender roles and the politics, and they're the ones who not only left the evangelical church behind, they spend a lot of their time being critical of the evangelical church, have no desire to go back. They still believe in Jesus and the Bible and a lot of Christian orthodoxy. They just really dislike everything that evangelicalism represents in American culture, politics, and society.
Let's go back to our callers. Jonah is with us in Oakwood. Jonah, hi.
Hi, it's nice to be calling in.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about Jonah?
So I grew up in the church. I was a Christian for, I guess you could say, 20 years then. I'm 24 now. And like 15 of those I remember very vividly. And the biggest thing I took away from it the entire time was not necessarily God's love or the love of my church to me, but it was the shame. That was the biggest thing that I took away. Yeah.
Jonah, can I ask what denomination, if you're willing to share that with us?
Yeah. Non-denominational, which itself is a denomination, and I think it's kind of funny that we call ourselves that.
Jonah, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Okay, a couple big points there I want to get into, Ryan. First of all, non-denominational churches. This is one of the categories, one of the few categories that has still been growing lately, right, Ryan?
Oh, man. I think that's really the only bright spot in American Christianity right now, especially American evangelicalism, is non-denominational. So if you look at the Southern Baptists, they're down 3 million people from 2006. The Presbyterian Church USA went from 3.1 million in 1984 to 1.1 million today. You can go down the list. Almost every major denomination has suffered, you know, catastrophic losses of membership over the last 10 or 15 years. Really, the only group that's grown is non-denominationals. In the 1970s, only 3% of Americans identified as non-denominational. Almost 15% of Americans identify as non-denominational. In the future, most evangelicals are going to be non-denominational Christians, and we always think of them as evangelical. Even though not every non-denominational church is evangelical, the vast majority, the joke is they basically look like Southern Baptists without the name, you know, in terms of theology and practice and things like that. And, you know, the experience with shame is very real in the evangelical church. A lot of talk about sinfulness and judgment in the end times, and it makes you think a lot about who you are and what you're doing, and shame is definitely a part of the evangelical tradition, without a doubt.
Jonah, thanks a lot for the call. And Ryan, your co-authors in this book, the pastors, talk about walking a fine line between, you know, wanting to present a gospel of love that might appeal to someone like Jonah, but not giving up on articles of faith and saying, yeah, there are certain behaviors we really think you ought to do if you're a Christian.
That's the I've always heard that good preachers should comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And how much you do of each one of those every Sunday really depends on what the passage is, what's going on in the world. And sometimes I think pastors do a little bit too much and not enough. We all need a pat on the head and a kick in the behind every once in a while. You know, do better, be a better Christian, be a better person. We also need to know you're doing pretty good and God loves you just the way you are. It's hard to hold those two things in tension sometimes.
Thanks again for that call, Jonah. We're talking to Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. He researches religion in the U.S. We're talking about his contributions to the new book, The Great Dechurching, which looks at why many Americans have stopped going to church and what it means for the country we live in. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you or your congregation? Have you seen this in your life or in your church? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Ryan Burge, political scientist, about the new book, The Great Dechurching. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're one of the millions of Americans who stopped going to church, love to hear from you and hear your story. If you're still there and seeing empty seats, love to hear your thoughts on why that might be. Join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Randy is with us in Madison. Randy, hello.
Good afternoon. I'm a nominal Presbyterian, so I guess I'm part of that dying breed. But I have seen, you know, shrinkage in the church when I go. I think this is a prime example of William Butler Yeats's most famous line: "The best lack all conviction; the worst are full of passionate intensity." And by this point, I've been involved in a lot of movements, political movements, you'd have to call them. And when people come around and immediately identify themselves as Christians, my hair is stand on end. Usually the Christians that we're going to be allies with don't put that up first thing.
Randy, thanks a lot for the call. Ryan, Randy pointing, I think, toward political polarization in wider American culture. How do we see that playing out in churches and whether people stay or go?
Yeah, if you look at the data, what Randy's talking about is ideas religion as a cultural and political identity, not necessarily a religious identity anymore. We're seeing the rise of the share of people who identify as evangelical but never go to church. Which is an interesting phenomenon. The more you think about it, the more you realize they're grabbing onto that label because they like the political and cultural connotation of what the word evangelical means, even though they don't really believe in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, let's say. And I think that's really what we're seeing in America is that religion's become almost like a totem, like a marker, almost like I root for the Yankees. Like I'm an evangelical, even though I don't really watch the games, even though I don't really go to church. because I like where that puts me in social and political space. It identifies who I'm with and who I'm against. And I think a lot of liberal Christians in America see that and go, yeah, I'm a Christian, but I'm not going to say it, because when I say Christian, the average person thinks Republican or conservative, and I'm not those things. So I won't lead with that idea. It's just interesting how in the 1980s, you know, Christians were evenly divided, Republican and Democrat, and now they're overwhelmingly Republican, especially white Christians. Now that liberal Christians have seen that, they've sort of pulled back from that identity as part of themselves.
Thanks a lot for that call. Randy at 800-642-1234. Ryan, before I go back to our callers, I want to check out another group now, a category of people leaving churches. You just mentioned white Christians. You have a category called BIPOC, the Black Indigenous People of Color. What story did you see there?
Oh, it's such an interesting story, Rob, because we used an algorithm for this, which is a computer generated, AI thing that creates these clusters. And we did not include a race variable on purpose because we didn't want it to use race. But the algorithm, for some reason, put everyone who was a person of color in our sample of de-churched evangelicals into this one cluster of BIPOC. What's really interesting about them is they have really high levels of education and really high incomes. And I wonder if a lot of the reason they're leaving is the politics that we're talking about, because white Christianity has become something else entirely compared to, you know, Christianity for people of color. Black Protestants, almost 90% of them voted for Joe Biden in 2020, when it was 80% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. So I wonder if a lot of people of color who are raised in evangelical traditions have left those traditions because they want to distance themselves from the MAGA Republicans they see taking over, you know, modern evangelicalism.
Let's go back to your calls now. Bryce is with us in Wauwatosa. Bryce, hello.
Hello, good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you so much for accepting my call. It is rather appropriate that you talk about the BIPOC aspect of your research. I am African-American. I was raised in the United Methodist Church with my father being a United Methodist pastor in Indiana for a 30-year period. I am 53 years of age, and as time has progressed and as I have gotten further away from my family, I have pretty much accepted agnosticism as my way of looking at belief at this point in my life, to comfortably say, I don't know, which in a general sense, my understanding is that's what agnosticism represents. And I'm comfortable in saying that. Number two, and then I will close. In the United Methodist tradition, I'm sure your author is very well aware of this, recently there has been a seismic shift within that denomination in that the issues of LGBTQ have come to the forefront in the faith, and quite a few people are starting to leave either individually or collectively from the United Methodist faith as a result. So quite a few things are changing from whence I was a preacher's boy sitting in the front row listening to Dad give the word. Thank you all so much.
Bryce, thank you so much for sharing your personal story, first of all. And Ryan, to Bryce's second point, LGBT issues, a lot of disjunction there between society at large and what's going on in these churches. How big a factor is that in de-churching?
So the United Methodist Church is seeing the largest denominational schism in American history right now. I don't think we're talking about this enough. It used to be 8 million people. Over 20% of those churches have disaffiliated over the last 18 months and joined what's called the Global Methodist Church, which is the more conservative branch of United Methodism now. So it's going to create an entirely new religious landscape. We are seeing a lot of young people who maybe not be LGBTQ themselves, but are allies of LGBTQ people, growing up evangelical especially, and going, I can't be part of a congregation that does not allow those people to be full members and do their weddings like they would do my heterosexual wedding. So I think there's if you even look at young evangelicals, by the way, a majority of young evangelicals, 18 to 35-year-olds, are now in favor of same-sex marriage. So it's a situation where the bottom up is overwhelmingly in favor of same-sex marriage, especially amongst non-Christian young people. But the institutions are holding true to their doctrine they preached for hundreds of years. And at some point, things are going to have to change in one way or the other as those churches continue to empty out.
Thanks again for that call. I want to talk a little about the impact of this, Ryan. Obviously, if you're a pastor, you're very worried about this. If you're a member of a church, you're very concerned. There's also concerns raised in the book about, you know, this is a great opportunity for people to participate in a community. And these are institutions that often do a lot of work, whether it's in education or health or social services. What are some of the impacts of de-churching, even for people who maybe didn't church in the first place?
Perry Bacon wrote this great op-ed for the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago called "I Used to Be a Christian, Now I Miss Church," and where he kind of lays out this idea. He grew up in church just like Bryce did, you know, in an African-American household, and he was there every Sunday with his dad front row. And now he doesn't believe in a lot of the doctrines, but he has a deep ache for the community and the volunteerism that church provided for him and his family. I think a lot of people forget that churches are also social organizations. They're horizontal organizations that help us connect with each other and then serve the community. And so I wonder, you know, how are we going to generate social capital in the future? Who's going to run the clothes closets and the food pantries and the soup kitchens, all the things that we're doing, these little communities across America? They're going to disappear in 20 or 30 years as the great de-churching accelerates. Who's going to fill the gaps? Who's going to step in? We obviously don't want the government to do that. Most Americans want a smaller government, not a larger one. And I love my atheist agnostic friends, but they have not shown an ability to organize these volunteer organizations in a way that can replace Christian organizations that are dying. And I worry about people on the fringes being left behind, left out, and lost because these church organizations aren't going to exist anymore.
Briefly, Ryan, is that necessarily the case? Your co-authors found room for optimism for revitalizing church communities in our last half a minute. Do you think that's a possibility?
Listen, there's always, you know, the pendulum swings both ways, right? It's really, we're moving way far towards secularization right now, but you see little green shoots in certain religious communities that are doing very well. For instance, the Orthodox Church in America is doing very well. Traditional Catholics who go back to the Latin Mass are doing very well. So I think religion's going to be remade in a different way. We're going to see new religious movements over the next 15 or 20 years, but a lot of pastors are facing issues like now, like how to get rid of their pulpits and choir robes and hymnals. And those are not easy conversations to have going forward.
Ryan, thanks as always for joining us today.
Always a pleasure.
That's Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. We've been talking about his contribution to the new book, The Great Dechurching. Who's leaving? Why are they going? And what will it take to bring them back? You can keep sharing your stories. You can email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The Biden administration announced last week that it was canceling 7 oil and gas leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska and proposing new regulations to protect Arctic wildlife lands. The leases were issued by the Trump administration as part of the 2017 Tax Cut and Jobs Act. That law still requires the Biden administration to hold another sale of oil and gas leases in the area by December of next year. Environmental groups applauded the cancellation of the leases, but want to see the White House go further to halt ongoing oil and gas drilling in the Arctic. The Biden administration earlier this year approved permits for the controversial Willow Project from ConocoPhillips. Meanwhile, oil industry groups and many elected officials in Alaska criticized the decision to end the leases. We're learning more about the environmental policy and legal questions about what the Biden administration can and can't do with oil drilling in the Arctic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the way the Biden administration is handling environmental policy in the Arctic? Are you glad these leases got canceled? What do you think about that permit being issued? What questions do you have about some of the legal issues at play here? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Squillaci is the Raphael J. Moses Professor of Natural Resources Law at the University of Colorado Law School. He worked for the U.S. Department of the Interior during the Clinton administration. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
This is a long-running debate over drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Can you set the scene for us a little bit? Tell us about this place, its oil prospects, and why this has been so controversial over the years.
Yeah, well, Alaska is just an interesting place in many ways, right? It's a huge state and has abundant wildlife. In many places, there aren't a lot of people, but there are some incredible ecosystems that support a huge population of elk and reindeer and polar bears and other kinds of animals that we don't tend to find as much in the lower 48. And so it's been a really important place for many conservation groups and efforts to protect the area from encroachments by oil and gas companies and other kinds of development have been ongoing for many, many years.
How do these kind of leases work, like the ones that were just canceled? How does the government, the federal government, take this federal land and give the option to buy these leases to companies?
Yeah, really good question, Rob. So what they do is they hold an auction. And so the first, there's a process for nominating tracts for lease in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. I mean, as you pointed out, they were mandated by Congress to hold a lease sale, I think, before the end of 2021, and then a second one before the end of 2024. So there were two lease sales mandated by that statute. But generally speaking, this is done through a nomination process, and then the government schedules tracts that are available for lease, and they hold an auction, which is what they did in the case of the ANWR leases as well. They held an auction, and the leases generally go to the highest bidder. What's really interesting about the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge leases is that there was very little interest in developing those leases. Except for one case, all the leases that ended up being sold were sold essentially to an arm of the state of Alaska. I think Alaska was concerned that nobody else was interested in those leases, and they just bought them so they could hold them, I guess, and hope that maybe they could transfer them to another party who would actually develop the oil and gas on the property. But it's a really telling result. The fact that there was so little interest in acquiring those leases in ANWR suggests to me that that land is not likely to ever be developed. And so whether or not the government had canceled these leases, I was skeptical that development would ever occur on that tract of land.
One argument I've seen is that, all right, if I'm an oil company and I'm looking at a Biden administration that said, hey, we want to end drilling on federal lands, well, maybe if I bid and get this lease, it might get yanked out from under me, as these leases did. Could that be contributing to that lack of interest?
Possibly. You know, the government will likely have to repay the bonus bids that the state paid and that the single private bidder paid if they're canceling those leases because they didn't have a chance to develop those leases. But I don't really know that these leases were worth as much as was sort of suggested before the tracts went up for sale. If there had been a lot of interest in the leases, I think you would have seen multiple bidders, and they would have bid the price of the tracts up quite high. But I think most people understand that it would be very difficult to develop the oil and gas on that tract of land, in part because it's somewhat remote from the Trans-Alaska pipeline. It would have been expensive to move the oil and gas over to the pipeline. And at the end of the day, they also know that because it's so controversial to develop in that area, they were going to likely face a lot of litigation, even if they were allowed to get permits to do it. So, you know, from the perspective of an oil and gas company, that was a big risk proposition. And also, I think what oil and gas companies are realizing is that the long-term prospects for oil and gas are not good. It's pretty clear that we're moving toward electrification of the grid. It's pretty clear that we're moving toward electrification of transportation. And both of those things are going to affect demand for oil and for gas, and likely then the price. And so if these companies can't develop this oil and gas resource at a significant profit, why would they go forward and try to bid on these tracts of land? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Now, in the short term, there clearly is some continuing demand for oil and gas, and the price has remained somewhat stubbornly high, in part because of price constraints that have been imposed by OPEC Plus and others, by Russia to some extent. And so the price has been sufficiently high that oil and gas companies are able to make a decent profit. But I just don't see how this is going to play out in that way over the long term. As the demand goes down for oil because of the increased electrification of transportation, as the demand goes down for gas, as we see more and more renewable energy coming on the grid, it seems to me that the price is inevitably going to fall and make a lot of these speculative kinds of development projects unprofitable. And that's, I think, why the majors didn't bid on the Anwar leases. I think they're looking ahead. They're realizing that it's going to take a while to develop those leases, in part because of the controversy and efforts to block the development of those leases. We're also likely to see that with respect to the Willow project that you mentioned. And so if you're an oil and gas company, you have to be thinking that it's going to take maybe a decade, maybe more, to actually get that oil and gas to market. And where's the market going to be in a decade? I think that's a really tough question to answer. And I think what we're seeing, or what we have seen particularly up in Alaska, is that there's been a reluctance for the majors at least to spend a lot of money to develop the properties up there. They're just, it's just too speculative, I think, at this point in time.
Talking to Mark Scolacci, natural resources law professor at the University of Colorado Law School, looking at drilling for oil in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the federal government be encouraging development of oil and natural gas wherever and whenever we can? Or are you glad to see these the recent cancellation of some of these leases there? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's look at that that Willow project now. Environmentalists largely happy about the cancellation of these leases. Unhappy, though, with the Biden administration approving the permit for that Willow project from ConocoPhillips to drill in the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska. Now, this is a different stage of the process, as I understand it. Mark, correct me if I'm wrong. The lease was already there. This permit says, okay, yeah, we're approving your plan to drill using this lease.
Right. Right. So we talked a little bit at the beginning about how this goes. And as I mentioned, there's an auction to decide who gets to buy the lease. After the lease is purchased, then the company that has the lease has a right to develop that property, but not in any particular way. They still have to apply to the government for what's called a permit to drill. And so we talk about this as an application for a permit to drill, or an APD. That has to go through a whole environmental process on its own. And that's what Willow was able to obtain from the government, the permit to drill on that land. And we'll see where it goes. I think the government's decision in that particular case gave them a limited amount of access to the area and limited the number of drilling wells that they could drill on the property. So it wasn't a wholesale win for the company, but nonetheless, they're going to be allowed to develop that property. And as you mentioned, it's pretty controversial. I expect there will be litigation over their efforts to drill that property. Maybe they'll be able to get it to market before the price comes down too much. Maybe they'll be able to make a profit. I think the Willow Project is an interesting one just in terms of thinking about where oil and gas development is going. And I think one thing we need to accept is that for the short term, at least, there is going to continue to be sufficient demand for oil and gas that we're likely to need more development, including some development on public lands, maybe development in Alaska. What I would really like to see, though, is the federal government acknowledging that we need to start managing the decline of this resource. Over time, it seems pretty clear to me that we're going to need less and less of this resource. And so we should be managing how that takes place, making sure, for example, that this doesn't lead to wholesale bankruptcies in the oil and gas industry. That really is very disruptive to communities that depend on it. It's very disruptive to the employees who work for those companies. And oftentimes, as we've seen with the coal industry, when these big companies go bankrupt, they leave the workers and the communities in a lurch. And the CEOs tend to make out like bandits in this process. And so that's something that we shouldn't repeat in the oil and gas industry. We're going to have to recognize that in a decade, maybe two, we're going to be seeing a lot less oil and gas being developed. And how are we going to get there? What's the path that we're going to take to make sure that these dislocations that we've seen in the coal industry don't occur in oil and gas? And so Willow's going to be interesting. Maybe they'll get it in under the wire so that they can make a decent profit in developing the resource there. We'll have to wait and see. We'll have to wait and see if there are delays as a result of litigation or other kinds of concerns. But I would say from ConocoPhillips' perspective, this is a risky project. It's not just risky in terms of the environmental impacts, but it is risky in terms of their bottom line. And it's going to be interesting to watch to see how successful they are.
We're talking to University of Colorado law professor Mark Squillaci about the Biden administration pausing oil and gas leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska, while, as we just mentioned, giving a permit for an already existing lease earlier this year. What it all means for the U.S. oil drilling and environmental landscapes. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this? Have you been following this for maybe two, three decades? What do you want to see the White House do when it comes to oil drilling leases and permits in this Arctic wildlife refuge? Should we be putting more emphasis into getting oil and natural gas where we can find it in the U.S., or should we be working to de-oilify? If that's a word. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Mark Squillaci, natural resources law professor at the University of Colorado, with us today to check in on U.S. oil drilling in the Arctic as the Biden administration canceled oil leases at the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska, while the controversial Willow Project continues with a permit go-ahead from the White House. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see these drilling projects for oil and natural gas go ahead in Alaskan wildlife areas? What questions do you have about some of the environmental laws involved in all of this? Should climate change considerations be part of the factors used in determining if these projects get the go-ahead? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Kent is with us in Reedstown. Kent, hi.
Yeah, hi. Aren't the oil companies making a big profit, a decent profit now, plus they get government subsidies?
Kent, thanks for the call. Mark, people talk about oil companies getting substantial subsidies. Is that something that's happening?
The oil and gas industry has long enjoyed some favorable treatment under our tax laws and other laws that makes them able to take advantage, I think, of government programs. And so, yes, that has been a problem. It's something that I think many people have wanted the government to address, and it needs to do more in that regard. But in terms of your larger question, I think it is important to look at what's happening right now in terms of the price of oil and gas. It's reasonably high. I think it's reasonably high partly because, or largely because, of the war in Ukraine and also the efforts by OPEC and Russia to limit the supply. And that just can't happen forever. I mean, they can do that temporarily, but there are too many countries involved in producing oil and gas in ways that likely mean that, particularly as demand drops, the supply is going to outstrip that demand. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen maybe this year or even next year, maybe not in the next few years. So maybe that price will continue to be reasonably high. But think about it from the perspective of an oil and gas company. If you know that it's going to take 5 to 10, maybe longer, years to develop a new oil and gas project, are you really going to risk the expense that it's going to take to develop that resource if you know that demand is going to drop significantly and likely the price with it? I mean, this is all speculation, of course. We don't know exactly how this is going to play out, but all indications are is that we're moving toward electrification of both the transportation sector and the utility sector. And that has got to have a significant impact on supply. And this is just basic economics. Supply and demand likely are going to dictate what happens to the price. So if I'm an oil and gas major, and I'm looking at the economics of this, and I think most of these companies have acknowledged this, that the long-term prospects for this industry are not great. Short-term, it's anybody's guess, and as long as the war continues, and as long as OPEC can exert its authority, yes, they're going to make a profit, irrespective of the tax breaks that they may be able to get. But I just don't know that that's going to continue, and particularly when you're looking at projects in a place like Alaska, which are going to be harder to develop, more expensive to develop, and won't be developed for a number of years yet. I think that's a very risky kind of proposition.
Go back to our callers. Ernest is with us in Hayward. Ernest, hi.
Hi. One way to decrease the demand for that Alaska oil and gas is with a carbon tax, but that is a no-no, because whether you are a climate change denier or not, you tend to be a carbon tax denier.
Ernest, thanks for the call. Mark, that's a policy tool people have pointed toward as a way to, make that transition away from the oil, natural gas, and coal, the carbon tax idea. I don't know if that's a policy area you focus on yourself, though.
Yeah, I mean, you know, all of us who deal with these issues have talked about carbon taxes. It's a pretty interesting idea. I think it would be a successful strategy that could be used. I just don't think the politics in the United States, at least, are there yet in terms of imposing a carbon tax. And one thing that we learned from the Inflation Reduction Act is that the thing that probably works best is just government subsidies. Now, we could argue about whether that's appropriate or not, but we have seen the subsidies that have been adopted in the Inflation Reduction Act dramatically change the picture for renewable energy and for electric vehicles in a pretty significant way that I think is likely to have really long-term effects. And we could argue about carbon taxes, and we can argue about other strategies like cap and trade programs for carbon that I think would work from an administrative perspective, maybe are good ideas, but we have to look at the reality of the politics of these kinds of issues. And for better or worse, putting some money in and basically incentivizing people to switch to renewable forms of energy makes a lot of sense. And it partly makes a lot of sense because it basically is paying for the externalities that these fossil fuel companies are imposing on all of us. You know, whenever you talk about the subsidies that they might receive, we're not even thinking about the subsidies that they receive because they're not having to pay for the external costs of their carbon pollution. And so it does make a lot of sense, I think, to incentivize people to move toward renewable energy and new batteries that can power our transportation sector. I mean, those are really significant changes that came about largely because of the Inflation Reduction Act. And I think people have marveled at how successful those programs have already been. And they are contributing to a lot of private investment that is helping to jumpstart this whole renewable energy economy. So I'm really encouraged by some of those programs. I'm not opposed to a carbon tax. I just think politically it's not likely to happen. And so I'm really pleased that we're looking at this from a number of different angles. And from my perspective, what seems to be working now are these subsidy programs.
Mark, just a point of personal curiosity. I was booking segments on this Anwar story 20, 30 years ago. And it seemed like it was front page news then and really heated. It seems less so now. Since then, we've had fracking that lets us get to oil and natural gas in much more reachable areas. Is that why maybe there's not as much heat over this Alaska thing as maybe there was 20, 30 years ago, just in our last minute and a half or so?
It's a really good point. I mean, the oil and gas development that has occurred in the lower 48 has been significant at a time when people thought we were running out of oil and gas. All of a sudden, because of these new technologies, and we talk about fracking a lot, but it's really about horizontal drilling, which sort of changed the industry, which allows you basically to go vertically into a oil shale formation up to 2, 3, or even 5 miles and frack that whole area and pull the oil and gas out of that resource, which is something that just wasn't possible until about a decade ago. And so we've really seen a resurgence in the domestic oil and gas industry in the lower 48 that has really changed the picture for oil and gas development in this country. And so I think that has dampened perhaps the demand or the need to develop the oil and gas in Alaska. I mean, some people think that, you know, we're back at the point of maybe having already developed the better resources in the lower 48, but it seems to me there's still quite a bit of oil and gas development that is occurring and that is likely to occur probably at a lower price point than developing that oil and gas in Alaska. So I don't think we're going to see an end to the development of the lower 48. It may decline a bit just because of the resource, but as I indicated, I think that we're going to be seeing a decline in demand over time. And as that happens, I think it's just not going to be as profitable for these companies to argue in high-cost areas like Alaska.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You bet.
That's Mark Squillaci, the Raphael J. Moses Professor of Natural Resources Law at the University of Colorado Law School. He was with us today to talk about Biden administration policy and environmental laws on oil drilling in Alaskan wildlife areas. Still time for you to share your thoughts on that. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Kate brings on a panel of guests for a look at the health of American democracy and the impact of former President Trump's effort to overturn the 2020 election results. It's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Here's a question I didn't know I wanted the answer to, but now there's an answer, partly. What did mummies smell like? As reported in the Washington Post, visitors to a museum in Denmark will soon be able to smell the scent of one of the perfumes used in the mummification process in ancient Egypt. They can do that because of an urn from 3,500 years ago. Using chemical spectrography, researchers were able to recreate the residue found at the bottom of the urn. According to a press release, the scent mixture included beeswax, plant oil, fats, bitumen, pine resins, most likely larch, a balsamic substance, and damar or pistachia tree resin. I don't know what that's going to smell like, but researchers worked with a perfumer to recreate the scent. I'm all for recreating the smells of history, and who knows? Maybe this will end up in perfumes and colognes that we can all try sometime. Patent pending. This is Central Time.